call to order the March 21st, 2013 session of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. We are in session. Good morning to all of you, committee members and audience alike. We have a number of bills here with a lot of witnesses, and I can tell you that in the last couple of days, I've had folks asking to talk on every permutation of four bills that you can possibly imagine, and then some. It's going to be very difficult to handle these hearings one bill at a time. So I'm going to open momentarily on all of the bills. When you come to testify, if you would please state specifically which of the bills you will be addressing in your testimony, to make it possible for folks to then, should they want to review the record, know which bills you were addressing. This has the potential to become very confusing and possibly out of hand. If it does, I will close the hearing on multiple bills and have to reopen on bill by bill individually. We're going to try to stage manage this, all bills at one time. Appreciate your cooperation and help in assisting us to make this work and easier for everyone. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bills 2530, 2175, 2532, and 3177. That, Ms. Edwards, would you please tell us a little bit about all of these bills?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, starting with House Bill 2530, this bill would prohibit the importation of genetically engineered fish into our state. It would also prohibit the transportation of those fish within our state. It prohibits farming, cultivation, or incubation of genetically engineered fish in any body of water in Oregon. Prohibits the release and attempt to release of genetically engineered fish into any body of water in this state. It provides exceptions, but it also prohibits farming, cultivation, or incubation of Atlantic salmon that may come in contact with native anadromous fish and spread contagious disease identified by the Department of Fish and Wildlife as an imminent threat to native fish. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. House Bill 2532 and 2175 both require labeling of foods that contain or are produced using genetically engineered material. It stipulates that a packaged food would be misbranded if it contains or was produced using genetically engineered materials, and a label does not include a clear and prominent statement to that effect. It lists conditions for the food to be considered to have been produced using genetically engineered material, and it provides exceptions. It would direct the ODA to adopt rules, and it authorizes the ODA to inspect consumer commodities and products in possession of certain entities, obtain samples, and seize food to prevent offering of misbranded food to the public. It stipulates that it would not create a new public or private cause of action, and it applies to foods packaged on or after January 1st, 2014. Finally, House Bill 3177 requires signage in areas where genetically engineered fish are sold, displayed for sale, or offered for sale at retail for human consumption. It stipulates that packaged food is misbranded if it contains or was produced using genetically engineered fish, and the label does not include a clear and prominent statement to that effect. It lists conditions for food to be considered to have been produced using genetically engineered material. It provides exceptions. This bill also directs the ODA to adopt rules relating to these requirements, and it authorizes the ODA to inspect fish and packaged foods containing fish in possession of certain entities, obtain samples of fish feed, packaged foods, or packaged food ingredients to prevent offering of misbranded food to public. It stipulates that this measure does not create a new public or private cause of action, and it precludes any existing cause of action. It applies to all fish sold, displayed for sale, or offered for sale at retail for human consumption on or after January 1st, 2014.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Ms. Edwards to coordinate four witness sign-up sheets, so it's an impossible task for her. And please bear with us as we try to make this all work. With that, I'm going to I'm going to ask that Representatives Holby and Boone please come forward.
think about it.
You're frowning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Paul Holby, House District 8. I would like to open up by talking about House Bill 2530, which is the bill that talks about genetically engineered salmon, genetically engineered fish, excuse me, and Atlantic salmon. So many of you probably know we've been working on this issue for a while. And in light of recent developments across the country and in the world on genetically engineered fish and the proliferation of the aquaculture industry potentially using these fish causes great concern to the state of Oregon and to Pacific salmon. I will, say that we've been working a lot on talking to stakeholders. This bill's been supported by the Oregon Salmon Commission, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Community of Oregon, Native Fish Society, Trout Unlimited Association of Northwest Steelheaders, and the intertribal group up the Columbia, I forget their name as well. We have a growing list of supporters as people are starting to understand the threat that genetically engineered salmon pose to the Pacific salmon, which is extremely important to the Pacific Northwest. We are concerned about escapement primarily as being a big concern. We have experiences in the state of Washington and British Columbia with escapement of Atlantic salmon. We also have concern with disease and these farming operations basically having the potential of spreading disease to our wild stock of salmon, mostly because these operations are generally in net pens or in waters that flow into our Pacific Ocean. I will say that the consumer confidence in genetically engineered salmon is not great, though the FDA recently issued a preliminary finding, which you may hear of later, that these fish are safe. The jury is still out, and the science around that is being challenged. They're still in a comment period on that finding, and in fact, there is legislation in the federal system to accomplish what this bill also seeks to accomplish. I will provide later a letter from the governor of the state of Alaska, who is also supporting this effort at the federal level. The Pacific community should be greatly concerned about this issue, and that's why you'll find all the supporters on this. And, you know, there's a lot of perhaps misconception about this bill, what it does do and what it doesn't do. I will say that this bill does not impact shellfish. It does not impact triploids. Does not impact hybrids. And those are important things to understand. This is strictly about the recombinant DNA that's used in creating genetically engineered fish, which are not natural anyplace in the world once they've been recombined. The threat that this poses to the environment is also a great concern, because a lot of these fish, if they do escape, and not just the disease, but they grow fast, they grow large, and they're aggressive, and they can outcompete for habitat. And though you will hear that they're mostly sterile, which is true, they are mostly sterile, but sterilization is not foolproof. The science on sterilization claims that they are 100% foolproof is not well-founded. We have statistics that show that 95% sterilization is we found. And so 5 out of 100 fish that may escape could actually pose a problem. You'll also hear that while there's no evidence that this disease can be transmitted to our wild stock, I think the science on disease, as we know from our experiences with flu around the world, diseases and illnesses mutate, and this is too big of a risk for us to take to watch the native species of Pacific salmon potentially get decimated, which would trigger a whole series of economic impacts to the state of Oregon, from shutting down all logging where we have anadromous fish. If in fact the Endangered Species Act would come into play on some of those things, I just can't stress the importance of this bill, and for the state of Oregon to get out in front of this and be, you know, protecting our Pacific salmon. You know, the bill does, you'll note, allow Atlantic salmon to be raised in Oregon, but it has to be in a closed water system where they cannot escape, the way the bill is worded. So it does not eliminate that possibility. But we want to make sure that we don't have Atlantic salmon swimming around in Oregon waters or in the Pacific Ocean, because we want to make sure our product of Pacific salmon and the consumer confidence in that product is from the Pacific, and people have some confidence that they're not eating Atlantic or genetically engineered salmon in Oregon that comes from Oregon. And this is about branding Oregon as being one of those states that you can rely on some quality fish. I think that's basically, I'll try to sum up my comments with that, Mr. Chair. There is, a lot of things out there. I will mention that the FDA study that was out there that says that it's no threat to the environment was basically on the premise that the fish would never escape. It was based on a fact that these genetically engineered fish are in a closed water system that has no access to public waters. And we need to make sure that that is a scenario that Oregon follows, is that we don't allow these salmon in our waters. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I am on this bill as the backup singer. I am not a fish biologist or scientist. I'm a social scientist by training, actually. So I limit my scientific knowledge to the brain. That being said, this is a very important issue to my district and to the entire coast of Oregon and the state of Oregon. Salmon, without... you know, getting into the weeds on numbers, et cetera, and data, this product is one of our major stamps to be proud of as Oregonians. We export this product all over the world, and we're renowned for it. We have an industry, a fishing industry on the coast that keeps our coastal communities alive, and I think this is something that we can do to help, you know, ensure that. And with that, I'm going to fall into my role as backup singer, doo-wah girl, whatever you want to call me, and support this wholeheartedly, and I hope you do too. And I'm willing to answer some questions, at least try to. But Representative Holvey has given you the basic groundwork data for this, and he's absolutely right.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up on House Bill 3177 is just a bill that makes sure that in Oregon, those genetically engineered fish, should they come in to be sold in Oregon, which is also allowed, and that they be labeled so consumers know. And just real briefly on the 2175 and 2532, I think they're the same bill. You know, we just feel that since the science is out on really whether genetically engineered foods are safe or not, we believe people have a right to know what they're buying. And so we basically think that those foods should be labeled. You may hear that there's a huge cost to trying to label that. I will just say it's just like adding another ingredient to an existing label or adding any other kind of word on the label, that like new and improved. We want to make sure that the GMO label comes on those foods that are sold in in Oregon so consumers can make their choices. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to back him up on that. That 2175 was my bill as introduced, and it is the same as the 2532, I think, word for word. But that's the gist of that bill, is to label it. People want to know. It doesn't say you can't do it. It just says if you do it, you must label it as such. And I know I'm one of those people, and I received quite a few comments from people all over the state as to, you know, please promote GMO labeling of the, and mine is food, this fish. It's kind of, I've never testified on four bills at once before. So in that keeping, the labeling issue is the same, I think, across the food and the fish. If it's GMO produced, it needs to be labeled as such so people can make their own choices.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony, and glad that you were both able to make it to our committee. Any questions or comments for our colleagues? Representative Krieger.
Either one of you ever eaten any GMO food?
I don't know.
I was going to say the same thing, probably, maybe. I don't know, because currently it's...
I would only say that if they have, it doesn't appear to hurt them too much, so I can't see any difference in you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Krieger. I think the jury's out on that. I don't know. I will say that transgenic meat is a whole different ball game than plants, in my view, and something we should take a lot more seriously. Not that GMO foods aren't a serious issue, but I just come down on the fact that people should be able to make their own choices. They should know. We have a right to know what we're eating. That's why we have ingredient labels. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger, I could think of a great political joke, but I'm not going to go there just yet.
I have no comments about the furniture at the dais.
introduce Sammy the Salmon, Mr. Frankenfish, goes by. So. Let's see here. I have a number of our members, and I'm not remembering the exact order, but I think Vice Chair Esquivel is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, is it against the law now to bring these fish in and rear them?
I would say no. There's nothing in statute that prevents it.
Follow up?
Please.
I'd like to read something here from the ODF&W. Did you check with ODF&W?
I did. They helped draft the bill. They have rules in place that do prevent this.
Right. So then it is illegal.
In rule, not by statute.
Well, but it's still illegal.
Sure enough, but those rules could change, as you know, Representative Esquivel, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'd like fish that have been modified through genetic engineering and are released in wild populations have the potential of causing adverse ecological and genetic impacts. The department shall consider release of transgenic fish to pose a serious threat and risk to wild populations. The department shall not authorize the release of transgenic fish into locations where such fish may gain access to wild fish populations.
Absolutely. That was part of the basis for this bill. And the other piece of this bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, is that taking a stance and putting this into statute codifies that rule. And it also sends a message to the state of Alaska, to the state of Washington, to the state of California, and to our federal government that we need to take this seriously and try to expand this throughout the Pacific region to protect our salmon because they swim across borders.
Mr. Chair, or representatives and Mr. Chair and the committee, since I've been in this state, which has been all my life, it's always been against the law to import any fish that's non-native to this area. It will always remain so, and it always will be. And that's for 65 years. That's all I can speak of. So I'm not sure what we're doing here, but let's proceed.
All right. Very good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, that's actually not correct. There have been fish, non-native fish introduced in Oregon.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah. Ms. Representative, it has to do with ODFW is the only ones that do that, and they did it long before I was born. And that you're talking about Eastern brook trout, you're talking about German brown.
And bass.
And bass. But I mean, ODFW did it. It wasn't somebody that came in to rear fish. So it's never been done in my lifetime.
All right. I like to recognize now, please, Vice Chair McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Witt. Thank you for being here. I know this is a very interesting topic, and a lot of people are fully engaged in it. I just have one point of clarification in the bill, and it's your comment about the fact that this does not preclude someone from coming in and raising fish in a secure enclosed facility, that it can't, you're speaking about pens in the ocean, pens in the estuary, rivers, but if somebody wanted to come in and build a facility 100 miles inland somewhere and raise them in a contained facility, it would not preclude them from doing that. And when I look at the bill, it's and you may need to point out to me where I can glean that. It talks about an exception for ODFW, or the Department of Fish and Wildlife. There's an exception there, but it doesn't sound to me in the bill that there's an exception for somebody who wanted to do something.
Chair Witt, Representative McCown. The exception I referred to and what I spoke to was specifically for Atlantic salmon, not for genetically engineered salmon. And that exception is in
Section 4
of the bill.
And then it says the provision of subsection 1 of the section does not apply to Atlantic salmon farm cultivated, incubated, or indeed induced to spawn in the state by Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Right. In subsection so, 1 of that, if you read that, if I may, a person
please.
May not farm, cultivate, incubate, or induce to spawn in this state any Atlantic salmon that may come into contact with native anadromous fish and spread to native anadromous fish any contagious disease identified by rule of the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. So what that says is you can't do it in public waters. You can't do it in the streams, in the rivers, in the ocean. It does not preclude you from doing raising Atlantic salmon in a closed water facility.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Excuse me, but I can't remember whether it was Representative Unger or Representative Whitsitt or both of you had were next. Either one of you?
Definitely not me.
Thank you for being here, and I was wondering if you could discuss a supporter. We have letters supporting and letters against, and who is Pacific Seafood? They seem to be opposed to this bill. They've signed opposition, Pacific Seafood, to these bills, and I was wondering, are they a large commercial?
Yeah, it is. They have several installations from the north to the south of the state, and I have not seen that letter, so I can't comment on the letter.
I suspect, Representative Whitsitt, that we're going to be hearing from a witness representing.
I have not seen the letter either, though I have talked with their folks, and I suggest that maybe they should change their name to Atlantic Seafood Company.
Okay. I just was trying to establish, excuse me, Chair.
Representative Whitsitt, they're a major force on the coast. So.
Okay, they are in opposition to
and
the bill.
And I hadn't
okay.
heard, I know that I've heard that there will be hearing from them, but they deal in all kinds of fish, so not just salmon.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Klem.
Thank you. Hi. So I am curious about, I'm trying to decipher it myself, so I didn't have to ask, but how does the labeling work if something typically isn't labeled at all, like, for example, a pear? Not that mine, it turns out, they're not genetically modified in any way at the moment, but...
Are you sure?
Yeah, I asked. I went yesterday and asked. No, I asked. So I have no conflict of interest. How does the labeling work if there's no label on currently, on like a whole piece of fruit? in the bill, because it talks about packaging, and if there's no packaging on something, either of the two labeling bills, that's what I was trying to decipher. Okay. It refers to a packaged food, which may mean a fresh piece of produce isn't covered because it's not a packaged food, potentially. But that's what I was trying to discern.
I'll let Representative Boone perhaps answer that one, but I think it does refer to packaged food, and when it comes in a package in a box, like in a crate, it's probably labeled on that, and it would be incumbent upon the retailer to post that with signage.
So it's not intended to be on each individual item. It would be, it's not the grower doing it, it's the retailer.
Representative, let me interrupt here. Representative Clem, I think we're going to have some experts on labeling, and I'm not sure our two representatives are necessarily labeling experts. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not a labeling expert.
So we'll probably have some folks who are better placed to answer that question. Representative Thompson, please.
Just a clarification of what I thought I heard. We have a fish and game rule against this, but that rule can be changed. So then I am assuming you're saying if we put it in statute, statutes are never changed.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Oh, good.
Representative
Glad.
Thompson, because as you know, we change statutes all the time.
Right.
But it would prevent the agency from changing this rule. It would have to come back to the legislature to change it to be codified.
Thank you. Anyone else at this point? Colleagues, thank you both very much. Appreciate your appearance, and welcome to both of you. So thanks very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Before I begin calling other witnesses, is there anyone here representing the state of Oregon that would like to testify on any of the four bills? I'm not seeing anyone. With that, I would like to call up, Allison von Enneman and John DiLorenzo, please. Good morning, and welcome to our committee.
Morning.
Please decide among yourselves who goes first.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah.
Or do you want to go first?
Okay. Sure. Good morning. My name is Allison van Enenum, and I'm a cooperative extension specialist at the University of California in Davis. And my speciality is animal biotechnology and genomics and genetic engineering of animals. My training includes a Bachelor of Ag Science from the University of Melbourne. That's where the accent comes from. And both an MS in animal science and a PhD in genetics from UC Davis. I'm a past member of the National USDA Advisory Committee on Biotech in the 21st Century. And in September 2010, I served as a subject matter expert on the FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine's Veterinary Medicine Advisory Committee that was responsible for reviewing the data package associated with the genetically engineered Aqua Advantage salmon. So thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. Basically, I'm a scientist, and I just want to discuss the science behind this scary-sounding technology, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have regarding genetic engineering of animals, and specifically the Aqua Advantage salmon that this bill pertains to. So at the moment, I'm here to speak on House Bill 2530, which is the one basically prohibiting genetically engineered fish in the state of Oregon. And I also will comment on the accompanying bill on the labeling, the 3177, that requires signage in the area where genetically engineered fish are going to be sold. And in that case, we're talking fillets rather than live fish. So with regard to the prohibition of genetically engineered fish in Oregon, I guess I would just like to give a little bit of background as to what's going on with regards to genetic engineering in fish and the rationale behind it. And a major focus of this research is really trying to use biotechnology and genetic engineering to increase food availability and reduce production costs, specifically through the precise and careful rearrangement of the genes and chromosomes of cultivated species. And
Researchers are working on a number of different transgenic fish, Atlantic salmon, the point of discussion today, also rainbow and cutthroat trout, tilapia, striped bass, mudloach, channel catfish, common carp, Indian major carp, goldfish, madaka, northern pike, red and silver sea bream, walleye and zebrafish. So there's a lot of research going on. Nothing is in the market at the moment or available for sale or consumption at this particular time. And researchers are working on things like trying to speed up the growth rate, like the aqua managed salmon, improve feed conversion efficiency, thereby decreasing waste per pound of fish. Disease resistance is a really important target trait. Cold tolerance and improved metabolism of land-based plants so that fish can be fed less fish-derived feed in aquacultural settings. And aquaculture is going to be required in order to be able to fill the need we have for fish products in the future. The capture fisheries are not going to be able to support the increase that the world population is going to demand from fisheries. And this is a really important technology to actually reduce pressure on our wild caught fish. So if aquaculture can provide food, we can reduce pressure on our wild fisheries. And that really, I think, to me, the best way to support our wild fisheries is to have a very efficient aquacultural system and not eat our wild fish. So prior to commercialization of genetically engineered animals, and this is a really important point that's summarized in this little CAST document that I handed out to you guys, they have to go through a very rigorous regulatory process. The aqua-advantaged salmon, the progenitor or the fish that originally where the gene was inserted, happened in 1989. That was the founder event. It has been in regulatory for 15 plus years. And so any statement that there is no regulatory process in place for genetically engineered animals is just not the case. And basically they're subject to a mandatory pre-market regulatory review, and the FDA goes through a multi-step scientific review process that's described in detail in that document that I handed out to you. But basically they're looking at the safety of the genetically engineered construct to the animal, the safety of the food from that animal, and whether or not the animal actually does what the sponsor says. In this case, it gets to market weight in half the time that it takes to a normal non-genetically engineered Atlantic salmon to get to market weight. They don't get bigger. They are just getting to market weight in about 18 months rather than 3 years. And I should mention that Atlantic salmon are a different species to Pacific salmon, and they really are almost a different market in the U.S. marketplace. There's 97% of all our Atlantic salmon is imported from Norway and Chile, grown in other countries, whereas you're well aware Pacific salmon is a wild-caught fisheries off the coast here, and that represents about a third of the salmon that's eaten in the U.S., and they're two quite distinct products and also two quite distinct species. So they look at the safety of the fish, whether it grows fast, and if it's a food, they assess whether or not the composition of edible tissues differs from conventional fish and whether they pose more allergenic risk. And to meet the requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act, the FDA evaluates an environmental assessment of the genetically engineered animal and of conditions proposed for raising it. To date, only one genetically engineered animal for a food application has come before the FDA, and that's the aqua-advantaged salmon. And basically, as I said, that's been through about a 15-year regulatory review process. And what is proposed there is that these fish are going to be raised in contained land-based facilities, in other words, tanks on land in Panama. And in order for them to have the fish grown in any other location, they would have to go through a new petition with the FDA. So the way that these fish are going to be raised is the eggs are going to be made triploid, which is a process whereby you induce sterility as a result of inducing triploidy. It's commonly used in fish. In this particular case, you'd have a triploid all-female group of fish that the eggs would be growing in this grow-out facility in Panama. And the grow-out facility is such that it has multiple redundant containment measures. In addition to the biologically induced containment that sterility offers, and then those fillets
having been approved as safe by the FDA, and once it's been approved by the FDA, would then enter the marketplace as food. So I just want to be really clear that the current conditions of use of this fish is on land. There's no intent to grow them in fish net pens in the ocean, where there's the possibility of escape of those animals, and they can only be grown in FDA-inspected facilities, and at the current time, the only proposed location is Panama, in the highlands of Panama, with several biological containment measures that would stop those fish ever reaching the ocean. And so, to me, it's unclear what dangers basically sterile triploid fish in Panama that are Atlantic salmon pose to the Pacific salmon fisheries in Oregon. So that's really, I think, more concerningly as a scientist and someone that is interested in food production, I'm concerned that we've got a bill here that is basically going to ban genetically engineered fish as a group. And genetically engineered fish are not a recognized taxonomic category, nor really a category of animals for which there's any credible scientific evidence to demonstrate some universal threat that they as an entire group should be banned forever onwards. And if the AquaAdvantage salmon was approved, as I mentioned, it could not be imported or grown out in Oregon under the proposed conditions of use that the FDA is putting on this fish as part of the approval process. And arbitrarily banning production technologies can have unanticipated effects in terms of forestalling future applications that might be highly beneficial and well aligned with food safety and security goals. And examples might include disease-resistant fish and fish with improved metabolism of land-based plants with the potential to reduce aquaculture's reliance on fish meal and fish oil-based diets. And so that's what I'm going to say about the banning of genetically engineered fish as a group. I notice the bill also proposes to ban Atlantic salmon farming in general, and it seemed from a report I read on Oregon Live that the concern was that the Atlantic salmon were going to have a deleterious effect on the wild Pacific populations. And I just want to go over a little bit of what the science says in that regard, because we have had Atlantic salmon being grown in both Canada and the state of Washington for a number of years. And there's a comprehensive report by the Northwest Fisheries Science Center of NOAA, the National Marine Fisheries Service, which looked at the potential impacts of Atlantic salmon culture on the Puget Sound Chinook salmon and Hood Canal summer on chum salmon in Washington State. And as is outlined in my testimony, they basically found that there were very little risks associated with, in this case, escaped net pen Atlantic salmon. We're not talking GE anymore. And the expectation that they would increase current disease incidence was low. The risk that they would escape and compete with wild salmon for food and habitat was low, considering their well-known inability to succeed away from their historic range. And the risk that the salmon farms would adversely impact their habitat was low, especially when compared to other commonly accepted activities that occur in the marine environments. And one point I really want to make is that there is no genetic compatibility between Atlantic salmon, which is the genus Selmo, and wild Pacific salmon, which is the genus Oncorhynchus. They are different, not only different species, they're different genera, right? And so it's like a dog and a cat. They cannot have viable offspring. They're not biologically compatible. And there's been no genetic compatibility ever reported in the Pacific Northwest or elsewhere. And in the past century, there's been numerous attempts, actually, in the United States and elsewhere to establish Atlantic salmon outside of their native range. And at least 170 attempts have occurred in 34 different states where Atlantic salmon were not native, including Washington, Oregon, and California. And none of these efforts were successful. No reproduction by Atlantic salmon was verified after introductions into the water of these states. And in California, my home state, attempting to establish Atlantic salmon populations have been discontinued because of the expectation of successful introductions is, quote, so remote that it does not warrant the effort or expense of an attempt. And that was from 1997. So it's unlikely that they're going to pose a risk to the Pacific
salmon populations. And in a comprehensive review of 14 biological status reviews published by the National Marine Fisheries Service, their conclusion was Atlantic salmon farms have not been identified as the cause of any adverse effects in any of the 14 reviews conducted to date, which cover 58 separate evolutionary significant units for Pacific salmon species or factors in the decline of West Coast populations of hammock salmon or steelhead. And so I think the scientific data is pretty strong that there hasn't been any problems associated with the Atlantic salmon farming that has been going on in Washington and the Pacific species. My final point relates to the mandatory signage in the area where genetically engineered fish fillets, in this case, might be sold. And the bill states that the State Department of Ag rules will not be more restrictive than the laws and rules of the Federal Food and Drug Administration. I'll leave it to the next speaker to address some of the legal attributes of that. But I just want to make the point that the science is not out on the safety of genetically engineered food. The science is very definitely in. And the National Research Council found that foods from GE animals as a class do not present different or greater food safety concerns than their conventional counterparts. The FDA likewise does not find that they differ materially in the nutritional value, organoleptic properties, or functional characteristics, and therefore the FDA cannot mandate a label on something that doesn't differ in a material way. And I'll leave it to my colleague to make that particular point. But if we look at the GE fish that potentially is coming to the market, and most likely that's the Aqua Advantage salmon, that's the only one that's in the market, the FDA concluded it is as safe as food from conventional Atlantic salmon, and there is a reasonable certainty of no harm from the consumption of food from the animal. And the stated purpose of this bill is to preserve the public peace, health and safety. But the labelling of GE, it's not a food safety issue. The World Health Association, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Medical Association, more than 300 independent studies on the health and safety of GE foods have reached the same determination that foods made using GE ingredients are safe and in fact are substantially equivalent to conventional alternatives. And so I don't agree that the science is out. That's about as positive a statement as you can make. And I think it's likely that if I see a mandatory sign that says genetically engineered and I'm the general public, I'm going to perceive that as some sort of a warning signal that there's something about inherently unsafe about that particular product. Voluntary process-based labeling is already allowed in the US marketplace. Kosher, organic, GMO-free, free-range, biodynamic. You go into the grocery store, there's many, many voluntary process-based labels that are in the marketplace. And mandatory food labeling should be reserved for food safety and correctly identifying material differences in the nutritional content or some other material attribute of the food. And the voluntary process gives the consumer that choice in the marketplace right now. I would also note, just ironically, that given the requirements of the country of origin labelling, the COOL Act, which if you go into the supermarkets here, you'll see that fish have where they're raised and whether they're farm-raised or wild, it will happen that they will actually, if we're talking about the Aqua Advantage salmon, it will have a unique identifier. It's going to say farm-raised Atlantic salmon, product of Panama. And so there will actually be a unique identifier if people do want to avoid that fish. And I just want to finish with a quote from Greg Jaffe, who is with the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and he spoke at an FDA hearing on the labeling of food for Aqua Advantage salmon that was held in Washington, D.C. in 2010. And his statement was that the Center for Science in the Public Interest believes it's very important that the language required on the label be neutral and informative. FDA should not require that the label include the words genetically engineered. As mentioned earlier, there are many production methods for food products and many production methods for salmon. Identifying this production method without requiring all the other production methods to be identified would needlessly discriminate against genetic engineering and not provide the consumer with information about the material differences in this particular salmon. In addition, whatever label information is required, it would be important that the FDA, salmon industry, sponsor and other food chain participants educate consumers about the label and the information it contains. means. Providing information without education about what the information means is not particularly helpful to the consumer.
Dr. Ennen, that quote that you just read was from whom again?
That was from Greg Jaffe from Center for Science and the Public Interest. There was a hearing following the safety evaluation of the fish on whether this product should be labeled that was held by the FDA in September 2010, and that was where that quote came from.
Thank you very much. And does that complete your testimony?
That completes my testimony.
Ask your indulgence here just for a moment, please, and I apologize, but we have one of our colleagues here who probably needs to testify. And before we get into questions, I'd like Representative Gomberg to have an opportunity to come forward and testify, please.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good morning, Representative Gomberg. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 out on the Central Coast, and I'm going to be very brief today. As you indicated, I need to get back and continue a hearing in another room. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3177, and I know that you've had testimony on that already today.
Yes.
I didn't hear that testimony, so I'm going to just amend my remarks to try and avoid to avoid any redundancies. So I've been listening to the presentation here earlier today. I'm here to support the labeling of products, and I'm not really an expert in safety, but I consider myself a consumer and perhaps even an expert in consumerism. And I heard the testimony respectfully just a few moments ago that we maybe should be looking at voluntary labeling, and I would submit to you that if the industry regarded the genetic modification of these products as a positive, they would be anxious to label it as such. And perhaps there's some indication that they see that consumers aren't quite ready for this product in the marketplace. You know, for me, it's a really simple kind of equation. You go into a restaurant, you look at the menu, you say, "Is the fish fresh?" Is the fish fresh? And you listen to the answer. And if the answer is not clear, if the answer is ambiguous, that affects your buying decision. Well, consumers are becoming increasingly sophisticated. We've got studies that show that consumers struggle to distinguish seafoods in the marketplace. And as they become increasingly sophisticated, are we going to see them going into the market saying, "Is the fish genetically engineered?" And you go into a restaurant and you say, is the fish real? Is it genetically engineered? And if the answer is unclear, you buy the steak. And that's very simply what I'm concerned about. I come from a district with a $500 million seafood industry. I'm talking about 16,000 living wage jobs, and I'm talking about concern in the marketplace that our own indigenous products may be affected by changes in the marketplace, and all we simply want to do is let the consumers know what's out there. Maybe it's the same way my jacket is labeled, whether it's polyester, silk, or wool. Anyway, I just I wanted to amend my remarks and be a little bit informal with you this morning, but I wanted to share those concerns, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for our colleague? Representative Gomberg, please, Representative Reardon.
Thank you. How long have you been eating genetically modified food?
You know, the problem with that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Reardon, I don't know how long I've been eating genetically modified food because there's no warning labels on it.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson, please.
This is a curious aside, but you brought up the fisheries industry. I think it would be, if we're really interested in labeling, we may want to take a closer look at that industry.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, there have been instances that are well documented, they're part of the rules, allowing what we used to call trash fish to now be labeled as whitefish. So labeling, according to species, origin, all those kinds of things, is a little loose anyway. I would suggest that if we want to get into truth of labeling, we have a much larger problem than genetically modified in terms of where the fish is actually coming from and what it actually is. I share your interest in consumer being able to know, but I think we're well beyond that point with where we are now, particularly with fish.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate that observation. Again, I think consumers want to know.
Vice Chair McKeown.
I didn't.
But Representative Whitsitt, please.
My question is for the
doctor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much for giving me a few minutes. I apologize for the interruption.
And Representative Gomberg, we appreciate very much everything that you're doing to make sure that we have a thriving and vibrant seafood industry here in the state of Oregon. Thank you for those efforts.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And with that, colleagues, I would like to return to questions for Dr. Ennenen, please.
Doctor, thank you for coming. This is sort of a technical question, but I don't know the answer to this. When you genetically modify a fish, do you take a genome sequence from a natural fish with the attributes that you're looking for and insert it into the genetic makeup of the other fish? And how do you propagate future generations of that? Do you do a number of fish? I mean, could you kind of explain to us?
So I'll give you the example of specifically of the aqua advantage okay. salmon as an example. So in that particular case, there was a gene that was taken from the Chinook salmon. It was the growth hormone gene. It was hooked up to a sequence of DNA from the ocean pout, and that particular sequence of DNA is an on switch, if you will, that's activated in the presence of cold water. And so basically what this did is it enabled the fish to grow more consistently throughout the year, because typically Atlantic salmon during the winter months don't grow as fast because there's just not as much food in a native environment. That's good in a native environment, that adapts those fish to that environment, but in an aquacultured environment where they're getting their their fish food dropped on them every day, you would like them to grow consistently so that you can get them to market in the shortest amount of time possible. So that genetic construct, so it's about 3,000 base pairs of DNA, is actually integrated or inserted into the 3 billion or so base pairs of DNA that make up the Atlantic salmon. So the Atlantic salmon still makes its 30,000 or so Atlantic proteins, and then it has this one protein that's coming from the introduced gene, and that is basically was done back in 1989, one time, and from there on it's inherited in the same way that blue eyes is inherited in humans or any other characteristic. So it is passed on from parent to progeny. And so that's basically, it's just regular old breeding. So the genetic engineering was done last century, and we basically have been going through the approval process to bring that one transgenic event to the market. And that's the same with crops also. So every separate event where a particular gene is inserted into a corn or a soy has to go through a separate regulatory review and go through extensive safety evaluations for each particular construct.
So did that single fish, you took the eggs from that single fish and then they propagated?
Right.
And then so each of those fish, so the eggs from those fish.
So actually half of her eggs would have it inherited and half wouldn't, and so you'd select the ones that had inherited it because you just have the one copy to start with.
How do you know which eggs have it?
They'd be the fast-growing ones.
Okay. Sorry. Okay.
Great. Or you can do a DNA test
eggs.
Also.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Anyone else? Yes, Representative Thompson.
You indicated that these fish grow to market weight faster.
Correct.
Did you say how much faster?
They get to a 2-kilogram market weight in about 18 months versus 3 years with conventional Atlantic.
So would it be safe to say then that if we're trying to feed protein to a hungry world, this is a way to get more of it faster, or
well,
the alternative might be to continue to deplete native populations of fish?
Well, it not only gets to market weight faster, but as with any animal production system, the sooner you can get an animal to market weight, you have a better feed conversion efficiency because the animal's not as live along, and so you have what's called the dilution of maintenance energy. In other words, you don't need as much feed per pound of fish as you would with a fish that takes a longer time to get there. So anything you can do to improve production efficiency has efficiency benefits and sustainability benefits in terms of food conversion. And this particular fish is about 25 to 30% more efficient than the conventional Atlantic salmon, which is why
it's potentially of interest to aquacultural producers, where 70% of their costs is feed, and it's of benefit to food production if you can have more efficient animals. And so, yes, the answer to your question is this is a way to produce more pounds of edible flesh per pound of feed going into the fish.
Representative Krieger.
Then the waste generated would be less?
Correct. Yeah,
that's a real problem in all hatcheries of any type.
Well, what's this particular fish? Yes, the answer is, of course, you'll produce less waste if you're only there for 18 months versus 3 years. This particular fish is such that it is actually being housed in contained on-land facilities, and because it does grow as rapidly as it does, it actually makes the cost effectiveness of this type of contained aquaculture a lot more attractive, and actually removes it is now a competition for net pen based aquaculture, which does have understood environmental consequences. And so one might argue this is actually a more sustainable, environmentally friendly approach to aquacultural production systems that's enabled by this improved efficiency.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you. In the housed contained facility that you're talking about, is there water flowing in and water flowing out? How do they work?
There's nets and several different things to stop any fish from. It's in the highlands of Panama, and it has a natural source of water there that's coming up from the ground. Basically, it's an artesian well kind of a system, and there are multiple redundant containment measures to stop any fish from ever getting out into that water supply. But that's basically why they house that particular facility there, because it does have an ample supply of the right temperature fresh water. They're all fresh water, these fish. They don't ever have a salt water period.
That's what I've been eating at Costco.
No, no one's been eating this yet. Because it hasn't been approved by the FDA. It's been in regulatory for, like I said, over 15 years. The FDA had its final hearing in September 2010, and we still haven't had a regulatory decision approving it. So you haven't been eating genetically engineered salmon. You haven't actually been eating any genetically engineered animals up until this point, although I've heard quite a few questions asking people when they started eating genetically engineered plants today, and that was around about 15 years ago.
Thank you.
And that the regulation of whether consumers get to eat that fish or whether they're available in the marketplace, I guess, is regulated by the FDA?
That's right. The animals are different to plants. It's a mandatory review process they have to go through as part of the it's a new animal drug application, and so they have a mandatory safety requirement that they have to go through, and then they have to comply by the conditions of use, which in this case, as I've mentioned several times, is triploid all-female fish being raised in contained facilities in Panama. That's the only thing that's being considered by the FDA at the current time with regards to this fish.
Thank you. Anything else? Vice Chair McEwen, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Just a clarification. So would the process for genetically modifying an animal species be the same basic process as genetically modifying a plant species? Is the process?
Conceptually, the techniques used are a little different, just because the way plants, they use agrobacterium, whereas we typically in animals have used microinjection of the nucleus of the embryo. Although with the sophisticated techniques that are coming along now, there's a lot of different approaches that can do it in a much, you can basically go in there and make a single base pair change in the 3 billion base pairs of the genome. The technology is moving along, and the potential applications are really very exciting, I think, from a food sustainability and perspective. And it's really a technology that's used extensively in the medical industry. I mean, anyone here that's a diabetic has probably shot up with recombinant insulin this morning. It's very well accepted in the medical community. We actually have an approved genetically engineered animal that's producing a pharmaceutical in its milk. It's a goat that has, and people are injecting that as a pharmaceutical into their bodies. And so it's a technology that is quite well accepted in the medical community, but when you come to food, it's just a whole different ballgame. But really, the science doesn't suggest there's any difference there, and the science just is not showing that there's any safety concerns associated with food from this production system.
Follow-up, Chair Witt. So could you give us an idea of the scale of the amount of production that you are either have achieved or are ramping up to in your facility in Panama or the facility in Panama?
So I don't actually, I'm independent. I don't have anything to do with Aqua Bounty. I don't actually know the answer to that question in terms of what their poundage that they're proposing to produce there is.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Woodson?
Yes. We heard the term earlier, hybridization.
Yes.
And so for years we've been changing cattle and sheep, primarily cattle, to produce a lot more milk and a lot more meat and make them hardier, certain species. So would that be considered hybridization, what we're doing? What are we doing naturally? I always thought it was kind of genetic modification because we were interbreeding for certain characteristics that created. So could you discuss?
Sure. So I'm glad you brought up that term genetically modification, and you'll notice I didn't use it at all because to me that's a much more broad term than genetic engineering, which specifically focuses on recombinant DNA. With regard to your question about hybridization, that's a very specific term that's reserved when two species are interbred. So a donkey and a horse giving a mule is hybridization. Fish do it a lot, and a lot of hybrid fish are raised in aquaculture because you get what's called heterosis or hybrid vigor, so they grow about 15% better. We do it in cattle breeds, so the black baldy you see out there, the Angus and the Hereford cross, you get those black baldy mums. They're great mums because they have that hybrid vigor. But what we typically do, and I think you're referring to, is what I would call selective breeding, whereby we're using techniques to identify parents that are the most genetically superior in terms of what it is we're looking towards, and we're using them as the parents of the next generation. And there are a lot of very sophisticated technologies that are used in both plant and animal breeding in that regard that I think don't have any regulatory scrutiny and to me can move progress in genetic improvement just as rapidly, if not more so, in a much less controlled fashion than this very precise technology. But they seem to get off easy because they're perceived as being more natural, although I might argue that I don't really see the difference per se. There are different approaches to make genetic improvements to help the efficiency of agricultural production systems.
Thank you.
Professor Ennen, I think you've answered just about all the questions I'm going to ask you, but I'm going to go down a list here to make sure that we've covered every base. You've already described the lack of genetic compatibility between Atlantic salmon and other species. And so I suspect that there is no concern that we have with Atlantic salmon interbreeding with any of our various kinds of salmon that grow in the wild here in the Pacific Northwest.
Pacific salmon are different genera, so there's no concern there.
Thank you. In fact, you testify that it's a distinct species.
Genus. It's even more than a distinct
genus.
Species.
Thank you. In terms of concern about escapement, I think you indicated that at least in Panama, it's grown in high altitudes, not in close proximity to any reaches to the ocean. Would there ever be any concern for escapement? And if that occurred, there's testimony, written testimony that's been provided to the committee. That suggests that escapement then opens pathways to other concerns like disease. What impact might a potential escapement, as improbable as that may be, would there be any impact disease impact on our native species?
I'm not an expert in this area, and I think there may be a speaker coming later that's more of an expert in this area. However, let's put aside the genetic engineering, and the question is perhaps, do Atlantic salmon have disease concerns for the local native salmon populations? And I think that the data that I read out earlier from the National Marine Fisheries Service looking at the potential environmental or the impacts of Atlantic salmon have found that there isn't disease concerns transmitting between Atlantic salmon and the Pacific salmon fisheries. And so the data I've read would suggest that that's not a concern. However, I think there's an expert coming later that could more... He's a fish biologist that will be able to better answer that question.
We'll hold that question.
Okay.
And I know that you indicated that in large part the purpose for growing modified fish is they grow larger faster. Is there any concern that these large fish, should they ever escape, as remote a possibility as that might be, would be in a position to be able to outcompete our native species for things like food or spawning beds I'm not thinking of anything else.
So we're talking about fish in Panama that have escaped and have now come over to Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the question is, are these triploid female sterile fish going to cause a problem? And that a lot of the concern that started this was a study that was published in by Bill Muir in the National Academy of Sciences, where there was this Trojan gene effect where fast-growing fish would mate with native fish populations and their offspring would be less fit and the whole population would crash. And there's no sexual compatibility, even though let's ignore the fact that they're sterile. That's not going to be a concern. So then the question is there going to be competition between the native fish populations and these fish that have come over from Panama? I wouldn't be able to answer that question other than the fact that we've got salmon, Atlantic salmon in Washington that presumably come down here and have not had any catastrophic effects on the Pacific salmon population. And so no good scientists will never say never, but I don't think the data would support that that is going to be a concern.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you. And then the last question that I can think of at this point, would there be any other realistically possible concerns for our environment that any of us have failed to ask specific questions about? Is there any lingering concern out there for the environment given either genetically modified fish or growing of non-native species of fish?
Well, I mean, I think genetically engineered fish as a category is like asking, are books bad?
Yes.
You know, it depends what's in the book and what species the book is. And so I could envision that you could make a genetically engineered fish that would be bad because it does interbreed with native species and it does have the Trojan gene effect. And you wouldn't do that and it wouldn't get through the regulatory review process. I think what the FDA has done with the AquaAdvantage salmon is it's put in place every possible safeguard it possibly can, and there's a realistically, it's as contained as it can get, and I think it's really becomes conjecture of these very scary sounding scenarios when there's a lot of risk mitigation measures put in place. I guess to me it's like, you know, getting on an aeroplane to fly up here. That's a really hazardous thing if something goes wrong. But I'm assuming that United has all of the risk mitigation in place to stop that plane crashing out of the sky. And I think that, you know, everything is a risk benefit, and there are benefits associated with this technology, and the risks have been so contained that I think that at this stage the benefits outweigh the risk. If you only evaluate the risks and the absence of benefits, you wouldn't do anything.
Yes.
You wouldn't leave your house in the morning.
That's correct.
And so I think that it has to be a balance. And I think on balance, there's positives. And I think it's positive risk-benefit equation.
Well, Professor Ennen, you have been...
Yes, it is.
We are very fortunate to have had you here today. And thank you so much for coming a very long distance, making yourself available to answer our multitude of questions. You've been exceedingly patient with us. And I'm sure that your students are very fortunate to have you as a professor. So appreciate your testimony very, very much.
Thanks.
And if you could, can you stand by for for a little while just yet? With that, I'd like to turn it over to John, please. Welcome before our committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I am here today on behalf of my longtime client, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, to testify in opposition to all of the bills you have before you today. I should note that this year is my 33rd year representing Oregonians for Food and Shelter. And they have, I have a long, long history with them, and they have a long history of representing industry in this arena. Now, you've already heard some of the practical reasons why you should oppose these bills. I would like to take more of a 50,000-foot legal approach to the bills and talk about three provisions of the Constitution which you should keep in mind whenever you analyze a bill that requires labeling or a bill that bans importation of any commodity. The first, of course, is near and dear to us. It's the First Amendment, which guarantees generally that you cannot be that the government cannot restrict what you say, nor can government compel you to say anything. The second is the Supremacy Clause to the United States Constitution that talks about the doctrine of federal preemption, which basically means that if there is a federal law or a federal regulatory scheme, it trumps whatever a state might decide to do in the arena. And the third is the Commerce Clause to the United States Constitution, which generally prohibits states from favoring in-state industries over out-of-state industries because we are but one country. So, one at a time, we believe that legislation that requires labeling of genetically engineered foods like House Bill 2175, 2532, and 3177 violate the First Amendment because they compel speech. Now, we believe that laws regulating GE food through labeling requirements or farming restrictions like those in 2175, 2532, and 3177 are preempted by federal law because they interfere and conflict with decisions of the Federal Food and Drug Administration, and they undermine the federal regulatory scheme for regulating GE crops. And finally, we believe that GE labeling requirements, like those in House Bill 2175, 2532, 3177, also violate the Commerce Clause because they substantially burden interstate commerce. And since the state cannot articulate a legally recognized benefit from the labels, we also believe that the GE aquaculture ban in 2530 violates the Commerce Clause since it substantially burdens interstate commerce, since the state is not able to demonstrate a legally recognized local benefit, and since there are less burdensome alternatives available. Now, yesterday we addressed a letter to Chairman Witt outlining the concerns in great detail and citing to authorities in cases which we believe support our position. The letter is attached to my testimony at tab 2 before you. Last week, while we were in the course of developing the letter, the Attorney General of the State of Hawaii issued an opinion on a very similar bill in the Hawaii legislature, which happens to agree with our analysis on all fours. And we have attached that opinion at tab 3 of your materials. Basically, the Hawaii Attorney General was asked to opine as to the constitutionality of a bill in their legislature which imposes labeling requirements on imported genetically modified or engineered produce. And in his opinion of March 12th, the Hawaii Attorney General concluded that the bill was unconstitutional because State efforts to require genetic engineering labels have been preempted by the federal government, so that's the supremacy clause. That labeling requirements violate the First Amendment protections for commercial speech, that's the First Amendment we talked about, and that the requirements of the bill violate the Commerce Clause to the federal Constitution. So let's talk for a second about the First Amendment issues. Freedom of speech prohibits the government from telling people what they must say. The right to speak pertains to commercial speech as well as political speech. And although there is a distinction in the First Amendment regarding political speech and commercial speech, it's interesting that Oregon's right to speak freely, Article 1, Section 8, makes no such distinction between political speech and commercial speech. The federal courts have applied a number of tests to try to work through all of this. Essentially, the government's interest must be substantial if it attempts to regulate speech, and what it adopts as a rule must directly advance that interest. And in the second test, it's called the Zauderer test, the regulation or the requirement that somebody have to speak can only be mandated when the disclosures are purely factual and uncontroversial. Now, it's our position that forcing retailers to display signs stating that fish have been genetically engineered or requiring the labeling of packaged foods containing genetic engineered components is not related to a legitimate government interest, which we'll talk about in a second, and is certainly not factual and uncontroversial. Now, page 4 of our letter to the chair, we cited a case called International Dairy versus Amistoy. And in that case, dairy manufacturers successfully challenged a law that would have required that retailers identify products that had been derived from dairy cows that were treated with synthetic hormones to increase milk production. The state was unable to argue that the requirements were needed in order for health reasons. In fact, they didn't argue that because there was no scientific evidence that indicated that there were any health reasons associated with BST. Rather, the state argued what the proponents of these bills have just told you today, that consumers have a right to know what is in their food, and they have a right to make decisions about their food. That was the reason that was advocated in that case by the state. That's the reason you've already heard from the proponents today. But the court held that that type of consumer curiosity, absent a health threat and absent any evidence that it is misleading, is insufficient to compel speech. And here's what the court said. They said, quote, "We do not doubt that Vermont's asserted interest, that the demand of its citizenry for such information is genuine. Reluctantly, however, we conclude that it is inadequate. We are aware of no case in which consumer interest alone was sufficient to justify requiring a product's manufacturer to publish the functional equivalent of a warning about a production method that has no discernible impact on the final product." Okay, just like the circumstances in that International Dairy Foods case, all available scientific evidence here shows that genetically engineered fish are simply fish, and genetically engineered corn is just corn. The only possible reason to motivate the type of disclosure is that consumers are curious, but we know that that justification is plainly insufficient to support compelled speech under these tests. Now, we also cited at page 6 of our letter to the Wireless Association versus City and County of San Francisco case. And that was a case in which the City of San Francisco mandated that cell phone companies had to disclose certain facts relating to radio frequency from cell phones. San Francisco required disclosure of what were really accurate and true statements, you know, in a vacuum. And the statements were that first, cell phones radiate radio frequency. Well, that's true. They do. And that cell phone users are subject to radio frequency, and the closer the phone, the stronger the radio frequency energy. That is true. And so on. But the court held that even though these discrete facts taken in isolation were true, The overall impression left was that the cell phone was dangerous and somehow had escaped the regulatory process. And the court in that case said, federal court said, quote, that impression is untrue and misleading, for all cell phones sold in the United States must comply with safety limits set by the FCC. In other words, the uninitiated will be left with a misleading impression that the phones on sale have never been vetted by the FCC or any other agency, which, of course, is untrue. So here, given the highly controversial status of genetically engineered foods, any required disclosure is not going to be factual and uncontroversial. Just like the cell phone customers in the San Francisco case, consumers reading a message at retail establishments may well assume that genetically engineered fish or products have somehow escaped regulatory scrutiny, despite the fact that the fish and other products have been approved by the FDA for human consumption. So we believe the GE labeling requirements in 2175, 2532, and 3177 imply a significant difference between products where none exists. The implication is not factual and uncontroversial in these circumstances where there is no plausible public health threat to address. The state would merely be requiring retailers to provide information to satisfy consumers' curiosity, which we know is insufficient to overcome the First Amendment. Okay, so let's now talk a little bit about the Supremacy Clause and preemption. Under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, federal law prevails in any conflict with state law. The Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act provides specifically that no state or political subdivision of a state may directly or indirectly establish as to any food in interstate commerce requirements relating to federally mandated standards of identity for certain types of food or nutritional or other labeling standards that are not identical to the federal requirements. Okay? Now, federal courts have consistently held that food labeling laws adopted by states may not depart at all from federal labeling laws if the federal government has expressed an opinion. A California court recently struck down a law that warned consumers of mercury levels in tuna. The court in Brown versus Tri-Union Seafoods, which is also cited in the letter we sent to Chairman Witt, reasoned that the label conflicted with the FDA's determination that a mercury warning was inappropriate. The FDA had previously concluded that a mercury warning would unreasonably discourage customers from eating tuna, given the overall health benefits of eating the fish. The FDA has repeatedly determined that labeling GE foods is not required. For example, in 2001, the FDA concluded that the presence of GE technology in food need not be indicated on the food label. FDA is currently considering whether to require a GE label on the Aqua Advantage salmon, and the GE posting requirement, therefore, in 3177 is premature at best because the FDA is currently considering whether to have a GE labeling requirement on Aqua Advantage fish. It will be preempted by federal law if the FDA declines to require a GE label on genetically engineered fish. The genetic engineered labeling requirements in 2175 and 2532 are also likely to be preempted by federal law because the FDA has not required disclosure of genetic engineered components in packaged foods either. Finally, let's talk about the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause, the U.S. Constitution, grants Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce and mandates a common market across the United States. One aspect of the Commerce Clause is referred to as the Negative Commerce Clause, or what's called the Dormant Commerce Clause. And under that, states may not discriminate against interstate commerce or place any undue burdens on interstate commerce. State laws that protect local commercial interests against out-of-state competition are almost always unconstitutional under the Dormant Commerce Clause. And the rule applies to state laws that directly regulate or discriminate against out-of-state commerce, as well as laws that appear to be neutral, yet have the effect of favoring in-state economic interests. A state creates an undue burden on interstate commerce when the negative commercial effects of the law exceed the local benefits of the law. So there's a balancing test there. Now, we believe that the GE labeling requirements, like those in 2175, 2532, and 3177, place a substantial burden on interstate commerce by imposing costs on food manufacturers and by depressing sales. Labeling increases production costs by requiring manufacturers to segregate products that are bound for the Oregon market and to produce special packaging for those products. In addition, there are economic studies that indicate that consumers are less likely to buy products labeled as genetically modified and will not pay the same price for GE-labeled products versus those that are not labeled that way. GE labeling does not provide any legally recognized benefit to Oregon consumers either. It has nothing to do with health effects. It has nothing to do with lying about the product. The FDA has repeatedly concluded that GE foods are safe and just as healthy as their non-GE counterparts. And my colleague just talked about that, but I want to read one quote from the FDA about what it said about GE Aqua Advantage salmon. The FDA said, quote, "We conclude that food from the Aqua Advantage salmon that is the subject of this application is as safe as food from conventional salmon and that there is a reasonable certainty of no harm from consumption of food from Aqua Advantage salmon." All right, so GE farming prohibitions like those in 2530, because that's an absolute ban, okay, for importation of live GE fish. They place an extreme burden on interstate commerce by completely blocking the commercial activity. I mean, there's no more extreme impact you can have than to ban the importation of the product. When a state seeks to block commerce, the state has to show that the blocking regulation is essential to protect the state's legitimate interests and that there are no less burdensome means of accomplishing the goal. Now, we don't believe that the proponents of the legislation will ever be able to identify any particular health interest or scientific reason to ban the importation or farming of GE fish. In addition, there are obviously less burdensome alternatives than a complete ban, one of which is in another bill you have before you, 3292, which isn't up for hearing today, but it's in the committee. That requires state permitting of GE salmon hatcheries. All right, now that alone suggests that the state permitting scheme might be a possible means of regulating, which is less burdensome than a total ban, which means you automatically, in our opinion, are going to have a violation of the Commerce Clause. So, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman and members, although the government may occasionally compel commercial speech, the bills you have before you all run afoul of the First Amendment. The compelled speech required by these bills is not factual and uncontroversial, nor is it targeted at a sufficient government interest like preventing deception or protecting human health. At best, the bills are aimed at satisfying consumer curiosity, which is insufficient to warrant intrusion into protected speech. The state GE food labeling requirements are also preempted by FDA decisions that conclude that GE labels are not required. The broader federal regulatory scheme also preempts other state regulations that undermine the federal regulatory efforts. And finally, GE labeling laws and farming restrictions will also violate the Commerce Clause by placing excessive burdens on interstate commerce. GE food labels do not provide a benefit to Oregon sufficient to justify the commercial burden of the labeling requirements. A ban on importation of live GE salmon also excessively burdens interstate commerce. We do not believe the proponents will ever be able to justify the ban based on health or other legitimate interests, nor can they show that there are not less burdensome alternatives. So for all these reasons, and because the Hawaii Attorney General has independently concurred on all fours with our opinion, we strongly suggest that it would be most appropriate for you to request the opinion of the Oregon Attorney General as to the legal validity of these legislative proposals before you act on them. Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share these concerns with your committee. I'm pleased to answer any questions you may have or to elaborate on any of these points at your convenience.
Thank you very, very much, John. Appreciate your explanation very, very much. I have to tell you that I found your brief absolutely fascinating. I was captivated by it. I couldn't put it down last night. I guess that has some commentary on my social life at 11 o'clock at night. But but this is and thoroughly cited. I know that you mentioned two cases. The Zoderer case, I believe that was a Supreme Court decision.
They're both. They're all Supreme Court decisions, except for
as was a Central Hudson.
Yes.
And I know that you just finished up talking about consumer curiosity. I noted also last night that Central Hudson also dealt with consumer interest, as Dr. Ennenen has already pointed out. There was no distinction made, but fish is a fish is a fish, I think, something akin to that. Colleagues, I have thought about this since last night, and I have a course of action plotted in my mind that I want to check in with you about. But before I do that, I don't want to preclude any questions that you may have of Mr. DiLorenzo. So before we figure out where we go from here, I want to allow questioning first. So please, Representative Reardon.
Well, not really a question, more of a comment. If the process you're considering involves staying from 6 until 8:40 this evening, can we take a vote on that, Mr. Chair? We need to hear from others.
I agree, Representative Reardon. Representative Thompson.
More of a comment than anything else. I really appreciate the work you did. Like the chair, I was fascinated with the reading last night, which also is a comment on my lack of a social life. But it brings up, in a sort of humble way, I think something that we need to look at in a larger vein, and that is we come together here as a citizen legislature with the idea that we're going to maybe change the world. And it would do us, I think, all good to pause on a lot of these things long enough to look at scientific and legal precedent on where we're going. And it's true, statutes have a way of being changed down the line if they're not right. But sometimes I think the passion for correcting an evil outweighs our knowledge individually of the path we're taking. And I hope you have another plan that will help us do the right thing here, and it might also help us in a lot of other deliberations in not getting way out ahead of the science or the law on things because they feel good.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Krieger.
I just wanted you all to know that I don't have any problem putting down information that he has written.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I was pleased to hear that my letter had become a bestseller. Usually, you have the more common reaction that it's utilized by those who are having trouble sleeping.
Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. I think by the weight of it, our friends in the forest resources industry appreciate your contribution to the committee. I had a question for both of you. Can you talk a little bit about, Dr. Van Inman, you come from a long way. Who asked you to come? Who paid for your trip? Or were you paid to visit? And John, if you could talk a little bit about who you represent as well, I think that'd be important for us to know.
Sure. So nobody paid me to come. My travel expenses were covered by Oregonians for food and shelter. They had contacted me last week because they knew from Ron Stoddish, who is Aqua Bounty CEO, that I had been on this and that I was a scientist that worked in this area. And I don't receive any money from Aqua Bounty. I don't receive any money from commercial companies, and I haven't accepted any money to be here.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, I had an early conversation with Chairman Witt when I expressed some initial concerns about these bills based on First Amendment preemption and Commerce Clause. He asked me if I would be willing to write up some of my thoughts. I went back to my client, Oregonians for Food and Shelter. They thought that that would be a good idea, and they paid me to write up my thoughts about it in response to Representative Witt's invitation.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Colleagues, if you've had an opportunity to review Mr. DiLorenzo's brief here, I have every reason to be concerned. Obviously, this is one interpretation. This is one side, and we all know that however many lawyers there are, there's at least one more opinion on something.
Sometimes five or ten more.
But I think that John has done an exceptionally good job here of laying out some history and cases from the Supreme Court that would suggest that we need to be concerned. And I'm inclined to ask to take what John has written up here, if we are in agreement, to legislative counsel and ask our attorneys what their feelings are about this. I really think that we're at a point now that if we don't do that, we have not met our obligation to uphold the Constitution, and I'm concerned that we would not be doing that if we were to move forward in working these bills. I'm not saying that I won't take testimony today. I think we should, and we should move forward with that testimony while we are awaiting an opinion from legislative counsel. Representative Krieger.
I agree. However, I would want to make sure we have a distinction between the legal portion of it as far as the labeling,
yes,
and the science to support contentions either way.
A very good point. And I think that I think if you look at some of these opinions, the science is the basis, is the foundation for many of the legal opinions here. Mm-hmm. Representative Unger.
Chair, I don't disagree. We should make sure we get the legal part right. But as you point out, there are lots of lawyers who will have lots of different opinions, and I'm sure this is not the first time that Mr. DiLorenzo has said that something's unconstitutional. And so it might also benefit to check in with the sponsors to see whether or not there's some other legal opinions that we also ought to consider before we run headstrong into legislative counsel. It might just be a prudent way to make sure that we're fully informed.
The record will remain open, and we will be open to receiving other legal interpretations as well. Yes, Representative Thompson.
I know this isn't standard procedure, but would it also be possible to submit this to the Attorney General and ask for her informal opinion, just if she can do it within the time frame we have, just to get another view of...
I think that's entirely possible, Representative Thompson. I'm trying to one rung on the ladder at a time.
Yeah, I'm looking at the compression of our schedule.
Okay, and that may be something that we will consider. In fact, that may be a discussion that we have with legislative counsel.
I was thinking more in terms of inviting her,
okay,
to participate if she has time to render something between now and whenever we have to have some decisions.
I also have the concern about ultimate costs of our analysis as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, I think we need to go with caution here on getting a hold of the Attorney General, because I believe they charge us for that.
Yes.
Separately, outside, believe it or not, it's government versus government. But the other thing is, if we have laws in place, I'm not sure we want to spend a lot of money anyway.
Well, I'm going to ask that Ms. Edwards accompany me to legislative counsel later today and seek some advice. They are our counsel, and I'm feeling the need to seek their counsel. So, is Representative Whitsitt.
So, are we discussing only the constitutionality of the bills? Is that what you're going to ask them?
Yes, at this point, that's correct. Anything further? Thank you both so very much for your in-depth testimonies. And I would also, it's part of the public record, but I would also like to ask if you would mind if we put this up on OLIS, if you would have any problem with that.
This is John DiLorenzo. No problem from my perspective, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
No problem from my perspective.
Thank you. Very, very much appreciate your testimonies. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all for your time.
Short amount of time left, folks, and I'm going to try and get up those who have traveled great distances. I'm going to ask up, please, Scott Bates and Jack Williams. Are they here in the room?
Scott Bates.
Come on forward. Yes. What I'm going to do is... Okay. I'm going to provide 2 minutes of testimony. We are more than willing to receive written comments, but in order to be able to at least get testimony for and against the bills from the general public, I'm going to have to limit it here. And for that, I apologize. We're going to have a timer. And Elizabeth, can you explain the mechanics of this?
You'll see a green light when it starts. It will start counting down on my end, and when you have 30 seconds remaining, it will go to yellow, and then when your time is up, it will go to red.
And so I apologize for the timer, but it's going to be necessary. Thank you very much. Welcome to our committee, and please decide among yourselves who goes first.
All right, shotgun approach. All right, here we go. Thank you all for being here and hearing our testimonies today. I really appreciate your time. 2 minutes, so I'll try and be quick. Chairman Witt, I'll address a couple comments real quick. It's important to note...
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. I'm Scott Bates. My name is Scott Bates. I live up in Portland, and I currently represent GMO Free Oregon. It's important to note, as far as specifically regards to labeling, and that's what I'd like to focus most of my comments on, definition of what genetically engineered food is and what it isn't. There's been questions about hybridization and all those things. It's important to note very much that the bill currently, the bills pluralized, very much indicate what it is not. And that so a tomato that we go out and get that's grown in at the farmer's market or whatever, you can marry two together, hybridization, that's definitely not a genetically modified organism. You know, you graft your pear tree, whatever, it's not that. We've all been eating GMOs since 1996, is when GMO soy was introduced in the food supply of the American people. So we've all been eating for a long time. Questions become about whether health, safety, and all those aspects. So there's plenty of studies that support both sides of it. For every study that says GMOs are bad, I will not discount that there's a scientific study that shows that GMOs are completely safe. But what is not addressed in those studies about GMOs being safe is whether or not the components that come along with the GMO are safe. Right now, the fundamental bulk of all GMOs that are done are for herbicide resistance, pesticide resistance, those kinds of things. Glyphosate, which is Roundup, BT toxin, those are your primary two ones. Right now, there's studies that show everybody's urine, it contains Roundup in it. So how does it get there? You can studies that show city dwellers have it all in them. I'm flustered. The point is that there, it leads to all sorts of health risks with slow exposure to it, exposing you to all of the modern Western diseases that have been on a large, up ramp. Which are your IBS, all of your gastrointestinal diseases, kidney diseases, obesity, quite an array of them. BT Talks is a similar one. They all lead, like say, to those things. That's in all of our foods as a result of these GMOs being there. BT Corn, which is now going to be 70% of our sweet corn that we eat, it's been all in all of our corn for a decade now. That is, you're now going to be eating it on, straight out of the corn. Every cell of that corn is growing, is putting out BT toxin. So the claim that there's not health risks associated with GMO is, you know, is highly false. So there's definitely merit to that. So I would love to address, you know, further in my testimony, our written testimony, I'm wrapping up, about those health risks associated with the things that come along with the GMO. Additionally, I'd just like to mention from a...
Mr. Bates, could you please?
Yes. We have a right to know what's in our food. Lots of us have varying religious beliefs. The Jewish community, the...
Mr. Bates, I'm going to have to...
You're cutting me off. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is Jack Williams. I'm the senior scientist from Trout Unlimited. We're here in support of House Bill 2530. I'd like to just make a few points. One, we believe that the genetically engineered salmon pose a potential harm to the wild resources of the state. If they would escape, they would certainly have an advantage over our wild stocks. And I'd like to mention that it's not just the Aqua Advantage fish that are a potential concern, but this would apply to whoever would have the technology in the future. We also feel that if introduced into food markets, GE salmon would erode consumer confidence in existing salmon products and harm fishing industries. Relative to the farming of Atlantic salmon, I'd like to make the following points: that escaped Atlantic salmon could naturalize and compete with native salmon for food and spawning habitat. I'd like to point out that Atlantic salmon do escape, and since 1999, they've been documented to spawn and successfully reproduce in streams in Vancouver Island. These fish do escape because of storms, because of predators, because of human problems. Parasites and diseases are an issue. Sea lice are a common problem in spreading from pen cages to wild populations. Parasite loads up to 73 times that that would be normally associated. I have references and citations about this in my testimony. Simply stated, the resources of this state in terms of healthy and fishable stocks of salmon are simply too great a value to... the economics are too great for these resources, and the risks of both the pinned Atlantic salmon culture and the genetically engineered fish are too great to risk, and I feel that our time and energies would be best spent in trying to utilize the great resources that we have in this state and protect what we have and utilize those rather than going into these new endeavors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How can this all doom and gloom happen if we don't allow the fish in the state in the first place with our ruling? You can't pen raise fish in this state. You can't import fish into this state. You can't even take a fish from one lake to the other lake. It's against the law.
If we can't pen raise the fish and we can't move the fish, then we're not going to have the problem. And I think the bill's trying to address those problems, those potential problems. So that's what I see the bill's addressing, and that's what I want to support.
Additional questions?
Mr. Williams, thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative Clem, you had something.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the gentleman from GMO Free Oregon, is that the right group name?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
How do you feel about the organic movement?
Well, fundamentally, I support it. I think it's a very important thing to you know, Oregon and the economy. You know, it's a big part of what makes Oregon, you know, unique. It's a strong focus of that here. Oregon's not a heavily commodity crop state. So, you know, we have a much more specialty crop state. And that's definitely an avenue that's important to protect as far as, you know, what is Oregon's economy.
Just one comment. I think it's been great too, and it all formed on its own without any kind of regulation of any real kind.
Right. No. Currently, a lot of that is, you know, GMO sugar beet is a problem. You know, throughout the, you know, southern end of the valley and in the Willamette Valley as well. So and that addresses or it poses conflicts to lots of. The chard crops and other beet crops as well. So all your Swiss chards and all of those, which are...
Canola. You know, we're going through it. I know.
No, yeah. I'm trying to talk about
canola. To mention that
smart.
Word.
Very smart.
we're having a couple...
I know.
Lots of other crops that are that. Organic dairy and organic beef is a huge thing in Oregon. Those are large industries in Oregon, and all of them are directly affected by the presence of the hay farmers switching over to genetically engineered alfalfa, which is a separate bill. I understand that. So, but you can't sell an organic dairy product if your cow is fed genetically engineered alfalfa. So, you know, lots of industries are impacted by that.
And that's all a voluntary, they created their own certification.
Correct.
Grocery stores built departments around it. Farmers are making a lot of money.
Right.
And we didn't have to pass a single bill to do it.
Correct. And but at the same time, all of those are is now at the threat of being, you know, challenged and or, you know, nullified as a result of the GE crops. You know, genetically engineered contamination is a big, you know, threat.
To organic.
Right, to all of the organic certification. You lose your certification if you do that. Now, there's no harm of a neighboring farm. I mean, I talked about sugar beets. You can, there's nothing wrong with farming conventional sugar beets. I'm not telling you can't grow sugar beets. We're talking about canola. You're saying you can't do that. Nowhere in any of all of these GMO-free Oregon, you know, things that we're trying to say you can't grow a certain crop that you want to crop, right? If you grow conventional varieties of anything right next door an organic farmer, you're not hurting them. But you grow a genetically engineered variety of that crop, and you are. You're going to remove their ability to retain their certification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got you a couple extra minutes.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Whitsitt.
So do you think that we should label genetically modified marijuana that's being used in our medical...
Right. I would have no problem with it. You know, I'd go right ahead. I mean, marijuana, personally, I can't say I've ever seen a label on it to begin with, right? So can't say, you know, but that's a balance. But you know, the bills try to really address retail food. So I will address your comment in that fashion, right, that it's about retail food. I did submit some amendments that there was some questions about pears earlier and whether or not, you know, how that's labeled. I did submit a tweak, if you will, an amendment to the bill that does try to differentiate that it is still addressing bulk bins and, you know, large, not individually packaged food, is that it should be written for that purpose so that you do know if your pear is or isn't. In theory, there is a PLU code with an 8 in front of it that would imply that, you know, it is or it is not. But so marijuana is not necessarily retail for sale, so it would not, you know,
I'm
not
legally.
So.
I'm going to have to cut this off. Dr. Williams, in your prepared statement, you discuss more at length, I believe, escapement, competition over spawning grounds, parasites, diseases. Colleagues, I would like the committee to read this over. We simply don't have enough time. We have a couple more people. Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. I'm going to need to call forward a couple of other people very quickly, 2 minutes. Nancy Fitzpatrick and John Ward Jackson and John Bielka, please. Bielka. I apologize, folks, but literally 2 minutes and we're going to have to adjourn the meeting. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Bielke. I work for Pacific Seafood as the aquaculture manager for our company. Our farms, we have net pen operations. Our farms have been in existence since 1994, located on Columbia River below Grand Coulee Dam. We produce about 8 million pounds a year of steelhead, and we sell it to food service companies and retail outlets like Costco and Fred Meyer's. Our workforce is largely tribal, and I'm passing out some handouts that I've brought today with me on our operations. I've been working in this industry since 87, started my first Atlantic salmon farm and steelhead farm in a rural community, which still operates today. Later, I moved to the British Columbia and worked for the largest salmon farm companies in the world. In 2005, I moved to Washington State, and I ran the operations, the saltwater and freshwater operations that grows Atlantic salmon. And I brought a handout as well. It says now Icicle Seafoods or American Gold. For the past 7 years, I've worked for Pacific Seafood and have been attempting to further grow the aquaculture side of our business. This, in the United States, most of our Atlantic salmon comes from other countries, and we have a $10 billion seafood trade deficit. The economic benefits of this industry are enormous. BC's largest agricultural export, and it employs 6,000 people, and they grow 150 million pounds a year. Washington State produces 15 million pounds of Atlantic salmon, has 100 direct jobs, 100 processing jobs, and other such as trucking, feed manufacturing, suppliers of nets, rope, etc. Atlantic salmon are certainly...
Could you conclude, please? I apologize.
Yes. There are many economic benefits for this industry, and I have also included in my handout some misconceptions about Atlantic salmon farming, which include the colonization of river systems. And I have just one little area that I would like to read, and it says here that between 1905 and 1934, the government of BC released 7.5 million juvenile Atlantic salmon in local waters. Neither release was successful in establishing Atlantic salmon population in the province.
Thank you very, very much, sir. Committee members and the public as well, thank you for your comments, sir, very, very much. Appreciate the abbreviated time, or apologize for the abbreviated time schedule. But after I've had a chance to consult with Legislative Council, we may have a reopened public hearing. But with that, at least for the time being, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2530, 2175, 2532, and 3177. And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much, colleagues.
Good job.
And my apologies.